next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Michael Shapiro. We're going to be talking about the choral music of J.S. Bach, specifically St. John's Passion. And our topic is whether this wonderful work of art is anti-Jewish, in part or in whole. That's going to be the subject of our discussion. And the reason we're having this discussion is because of a concert on this campus in Smith Music Hall coming up on St. Patrick's Day, Saturday, March 17 at Smith Music Hall, 7:30. Tickets will be available at the door. The concert will be put on by the Broke Artists of Champaign-Urbana, the Bach Group. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
My pleasure.
Michael is an emeritus professor in the Department of English here at the University of Illinois, and also, even though he's an emeritus professor, he's not completely retired. He's still the director of the Jewish Culture and Society Program here at the university. Michael, you've thought about this issue for some time and in fact, gave a lecture on it at the university, 5 years ago?
Yes, it was 5 years ago.
And tell us why it's an issue. Why does it seem to be a problem? Or why is it a problem?
Well, it's a problem because of the St. John, the Gospel of St. John. Of all the Gospels, it is, I would say, and I think I'm not alone in thinking this, the most anti-Jewish. There is a strain, anti-Jewish strain, in all the Gospels, but in John it gets particularly virulent. It's not just the Pharisees that are targeted, as they are in other Gospels. They're mentioned, of course, but over and over again, it's the Jews. John writes that they're in a skirmish, a verbal skirmish, with one group of the Jews, that their father is the devil, and everything they say is lies. And it seems to me, in fact, I learned something this weekend from Professor Michael Cook, who was a professor of New Testament at the Hebrew Union College, who was a scholar in residence at Sinai Temple. He argued that John comes rather late. It comes maybe around 100, maybe the latest of the four Gospels.
And some would say 90.
Yeah,
some would say 50, but no, that's the majority opinion. That's for sure right, yeah.
His reason for dating it late is sort of a circular argument, but it nevertheless seems to work, that there's at least three times people are afraid, speak about the fear of being banned from the synagogues. Mm. So it seems like it's a time when Jewish and Christians have defined themselves a little more clearly than perhaps in the times of the early Gospels. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the Pharisees, one sect of the Jews or one branch of the leadership of the Jewish people, but the Jews. And so that's the problem with Bach. So Bach picks up this, he's going to do St. John Passion. Of course, he picks just the Passion. He picks verses 18 and 19. And chapters 18 and 19, and he leaves out this verbal skirmish and much else that I talked about. But of course, the Jews are doing the crucifying in the St. John Gospel, and he dramatizes that with full musical treatment. But I think he does something else at the same time, and this is what I discovered 5 years ago. Fred Stoltz was conducted it at Cranard and asked me if I would be interested in giving a talk about it, and I didn't know very much, but I thought it was an opportunity to learn something. And Fred and others directed me to some very useful scholarship, including a book by a man named Michael Marison called Lutheranism, Anti-Judaism, and Bach's St. John Passion, published in 1998 by Oxford Press. And this is a man, Marison, who's a professor, I think, at Swarthmore. He comes himself out of a Dutch Reform Protestant tradition. And he's very sensitive to the religious ideas in the music. He's not an aesthete about it. He doesn't say, oh, just forget about what the text says. Let's just listen to the music. For him, the music is dramatizing a text. He recognizes that in that text there are some very problematic things for us. And he raises the question of how Bach is dealing with it. And what Fred was sensitive to this too. Fred did something very dramatic, that is, he had different musical groups at his disposal, and he kind of cast them as different voices. So, for example, the chorales, they're what's labeled in the piece are the chorales. They're not part of the biblical narrative. They are commentary on the narrative. The chorales seem to come from the perspective of a modern, that is to say, 18th century Christian, looking at the story of the crucifixion, at the passion. And it's that frame that Bach puts around the passion story that I think is unusual and interesting. And what the voice of the chorale says more than once is that we are the guilty party. Not, of course, the Jews play their role, the Romans play their role, but it is we, the sinner, who have had the benefit of Jesus' preaching and still remain sinners, that are the really guilty ones. And that is, to me, that was an astonishing discovery. And Fred tried. It's hard to do, it's easier in plays than it is in a work like this, to get this kind of sense of different voices speaking to each other, kind of dialogue effect. So I'm not sure it worked 100%, but I do think it's there in the work, and Fred tried to bring it out. And it's largely what I spoke about when I gave this talk 5 years ago.
We are talking about the St. John's Passion by J.S. Bach that will be performed on March 17 at Smith Music Hall with Professor Michael Shapiro. And let me remind listeners, regular listeners will perhaps remember, that next week we're continuing this series on this important issue with another university professor, this one from the Department of the Program for the Study of Religion, Professor Rick Layton, who teaches New Testament, and he will weigh in on his take on the Gospel of John and this Passion story that's used as the text by the Lutheran musician Bach. And then finally, our third program, March 4, here on Keeping the Faith, will be Professor Chet Alwes from the Department of Music, who will be conducting this concert of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana on March 17. So this is the first in the series, and Michael is first. And let me just say, in your reading of the Christian scriptures that Christians refer to as the New Testament, the Gospel of John, you've pointed out, is often seen as the last in the series of the four Gospels to have been pulled together, edited, written in a special context. What do you take of the argument that some make? I don't know what Professor Layton will say, but some people say, well, it's the translation, the Jews, really was a specialized term since probably the author was a Jew converted who was now following Jesus, but nevertheless probably Jewish, and that was a code word perhaps for the leaders of a certain party of the Jews who opposed Jesus. Do you make anything of that?
Well, I'm a little skeptical of that argument because the writers of the other Gospels don't do that. They speak of Pharisees pretty much, priests, and they don't generalize in the way that John does. Although John does in other places speak of the Pharisees. I think he's capable of making a distinction between the leadership, one branch of the leadership, and I think if it's a code, it's a code not just for the Jewish people, but for the Jewish tradition, the whole covenant through Abraham with the people, which is quite different from the new covenant with Jesus.
And there is in John that horrible phrase that he adds that the other gospel writers do not, saying, let this curse be upon us and all our descendants.
Yes, yes, yes. So, that's a good point, of course. No, that's not in the others as well.
Right.
What I was saying a minute ago, if I could just amplify this, I think Bach is using what I gather from my reading is standard Lutheran theology, this idea that the contemporary sinner bears some responsibility for, or major responsibility for the suffering and crucifixion of Jesus. And the chorale number 11 makes it very clear. If I could just read a few lines, I think you'll see what I'm talking about. This is just after Jesus has been struck by one of the attendants. And the narrative stops, and the chorale, which is outside the narrative, the voice comes in and says, "Who has struck you so, my salvation, and you with torments handled so roughly? Indeed, you are not a sinner like we and our children. You know nothing of misdeeds. I and my sins, which are as the grains of sand on the seashore, they have caused you the sorrow that strikes you and the grievous host of pain." Mm-hmm. And this is amplified and repeated from sermons by Luther and hymns that we pretty sure that Luther wrote, this idea that the contemporary sinner is the cause of the passion.
That the Christian should see oneself as having caused some of this pain to Jesus. Yes.
Well, I mean, were there no sinners, there would have been no need for the passion.
Let me give the phone numbers for people who may have a comment or question for our guest Michael Shapiro, who is the director of the program in Jewish Culture and Society in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences here at the University of Illinois. He's a emeritus professor of English. And what was your specialty, Michael?
My specialty was Renaissance drama, Shakespeare primarily.
Maybe we can talk about that in a minute. Let me give the phone numbers for listeners who may want to call. But before I do that, let me remind folks, let's talk about this. If you call, let's try to limit your discussion to what we've discussed on this program. We will specialize in the Gospel of John and its text next week from a religious studies perspective, and the third week in our series here, we'll be talking with Professor Chad Alwes, who's the director of the Bach group, and so we'll talk about the specific musical things then. But if you have a question for our current guest or comment on something he said, please call us. 1-800-222-9455 is the toll-free number if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana listening area. That's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455, and that will access several local lines here in the studio. So Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Well, Michael, let's do talk about, since you know Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice has often been cited as being very anti-Jewish in terms of Shakespeare. Is there a parallel here?
You know, when I first got into this study of the Bach St. John Passion, I thought, well, it looks like a very similar problem, and in some ways it is. You have a work by an artist recognized as a universal genius that has in it anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish elements. And but there are a couple differences. One, of course, is that Shakespeare is writing a play to be interpreted. Of course, Bach is up for interpretation too. But I think some music people might disagree with this, but it would seem to me that there's a greater range of interpretation that's possible through artistic choices in theater than there is in music. And in fact, the play has been adapted rather freely. Every production, in fact, these days has some kind of directorial intervention that you can't say goes directly out of the text, but it's more the director's vision. And I work actually these days myself on wholesale adaptations of The Merchant of Venice, people who think Shakespeare got it quite wrong and are rewriting their own plays in direct response to Shakespeare. The other thing is that Shakespeare is not scripture. Some of my colleagues in the English department may think it is, but most people would say it's not. It's great work, but it's not scripture. So with Bach, you have a different problem. Here he's using one of the four Gospels, and it is, of course, a foundational text. Whatever one thinks about its origins, it's a foundational text for Christianity. And it raises the question of what a religious community does when there are things in its foundational texts that really go against the grain of modern ways of thinking and feeling. And I think this is a problem for all the major faiths, those that have texts that are foundational. So what do you do? You know, what do you do about it? And this is where it's quite different from Shakespeare, it seems to me. Shakespeare is, first of all, it's fundamentally ambiguous. The play has anti-Semitic material, but it doesn't mean the play itself is anti-Semitic. You can easily, and it has been done over and over again, make Shylock, even though he does pick up a knife to take flesh from another human being, he can be played rather sympathetically. He's goaded into it, and he's piled on afterwards. So that's what I meant by the range of interpretation that's possible. So, but how do you, you know, when you have, let's say, anti-Semitic sentiments in your foundational text, it's a big problem. I've years ago read a book called Faith and Fratricide by Rosemary Ruther. I think it was published in 1974. She was a nun who, reflecting on the significance of the Holocaust, felt that Christianity had a lot to answer for, and that there was a well-known medieval tradition called Adversus Judaeos, the church fathers writing against the Jews in various ways. And she pushed it a lot further. She pushed it back even into the Gospels. Her conclusion was that the anti-Semitism is the left hand of Christology. That is, a breakaway religion or sect trying to justify itself had to demonstrate its superiority, and that those who rejected the new interpretation were simply wrong, or worse than wrong, just blind, stubborn, obstinate, so forth. And she called for various branches of Christianity to re-examine the tradition and see what you can do about these texts. Well, Bach's solution was kind of ingenious. He, as I suggested earlier, he tried to frame that text in a way, looking back at it from the 18th century. There are other things that could be done with these kinds of troubling texts. You can forget about them. You can omit them altogether. Jews will be celebrating Purim very soon, and we will not read the last part of the Esther story, where it says that the Jews slaughtered not only Haman and his 10 sons, but 500 people in Shushan and 75,000 elsewhere in Persia. We don't read that part. It sort of spoils the fun.
Judaism may be fortunate that there are no Canaanites still around to object to some of the passages in the...
Or Amalekites, right. Or Amalekites, who are over and over again identified as the enemies of the Jews, and we're told that Saul was punished because he lost favor with God because he refused to liquidate them all. Mm-hmm. So that's, of course, So there are all religions, I think, have these problems, and sometimes you can allegorize, you know, through interpretation. You can say, well, it doesn't really mean what it means literally. There's another meaning behind it. Say the erotic material in the Song of Songs, which some people find difficult or embarrassing, has been often allegorized. It's the God talking to the church or to the Jewish people, mm-hmm. so forth. Jews have a tradition of Midrash, which is a rabbinic commentary, rabbinic stories, which attempt to clarify and sometimes radically reinterpret what the scripture itself says. So I think this is a really interesting problem, which I've kind of just gotten uncovered in thinking about the Bach and the ramifications, I think, go fairly wide across the Abrahamic faiths, and because we're all which are committed to foundational texts.
I want to talk a little bit about the interpretation problem, but let me just say a couple words about Rosemary Ruther that you mentioned. She is Catholic. She was not a nun, she taught a professor at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Evanston, and that's one of her many interesting books, Faith and Fratricide. Let's do talk about the interpretation problem, particularly with texts that some religious traditions consider holy. In this case, Christians consider John holy, but there are varieties of interpretational possibilities, and we'll get into some of those, I'm sure, next week with Professor Leighton. But from your perspective as a professor of English, How far can one go? You say that in many synagogues and temples, people at Purim will leave out part of the text. Mm-hmm. But is that fair to the text? Is that fair to the tradition?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose one solution, and this has been suggested, a way of dealing with even with the Bach, is to change it, but to acknowledge that it's there somehow. You're not quite censoring it. And I suppose one could say at the Purim reading of the Megillah, which is the scroll of Esther, we could say, you know, we're not going to read it all tonight. We're going to omit the last part, but then you might as well read it if you're going to say that. We Jews rewrite liturgy, and so in the High Holiday prayers, where in the official liturgy, Orthodox liturgy, there's a great deal about sacrifice and animal sacrifice. Reformed Jews have cut that out altogether. Since the destruction of the temple, we don't do sacrifice, and the Orthodox Jews knew that perfectly well, but they thought we should be at least reading about it if we're not doing it.
So does the Orthodox Jewish tradition read those verses?
Yeah, sure.
I say, okay.
Sure.
So there's that difference within Judaism.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a question of how far people feel comfortable in revising. I mean, the text, people say this about Shakespeare too. The text is always going to be there. The full text is always going to be there. What you do with it and how you mount a play, what you draw from it for a certain liturgical purpose, you can't change the existence of the text, and it's you edit it as well as you can, and you hope you got it right, and then that's there. But then what you do with it, whether it's liturgical or performance, is another matter.
Now, on the text here that we're dealing with today of the St. John's Passion of J.S. Bach, there are all these references to the Jews, and the Jews said this, and the Jews cried out. Mm-hmm. Have you heard how that has been dealt with or in your reading? Or
well, that is the dramatizing. Bach is dramatizing the narrative. So the chorus, not the chorale, but the parts written for chorus, usually represent the Jews. And they sing, for example, when Pilate says, "What should be done?" They say, "Kreuzige, Kreuzige, crucify, crucify." And I know.
And it's a quite dramatic.
Very dramatic, yeah. And the music makes it very dramatic, right, too. Very, very turbulent music at that point. Well, you know, this is a problem. I know in town people I know quite well who normally sing in choral groups who refuse to be part, Jewish people who refuse to be part of it. They don't,
or to come to the concert.
And boycott the concert itself, yes. Yeah, but also not even we're not performing. So despite, you know, Bach's careful framing and Fred Stoltzfus's attempt to replicate that framing in visual terms, you're still stuck with those words, and which represent what the Jews say. And if Jews are asked to sing them, they might not want to. And
yes.
That's quite understandable to me.
Yeah. We're talking about the anti-Jewish parts of the St. John's Passion. If you'd like to join the conversation, do give us a call. We're talking with Professor Michael Shapiro. Champaign-Urbana, the numbers are 333-9455. Elsewhere, a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the host for the program, but I'm happy to let others ask some of the questions, too. And I see we do have a caller on line number one. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I had a friend a long time ago who said, I asked her, "Are you singing this music because it's beautiful, or are you singing because you believe in it?" And she says, "Because it's beautiful." She didn't have any faith at all. Since this program is Keeping the Faith, I wondered if you could comment on that, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Well, Michael Marison takes that issue up in his book. There are a lot of people who will say Bach's music is just rapturous and magnificent, and let's just listen to it. And that works for some people. He's, as I said earlier, he won't settle for that any more than I think somebody watching an opera, really going to get into an opera, would want to know what those words mean. Even if they're in Italian or French, you'd want to have some idea of what emotions are being articulated, and not only from the music but through the libretto. And so I guess some people can do that, and if it works for them, it's, you know, why not? But others can't, and others feel that that's settling for too little. That the genius of Bach is the bonding of the text and the music.
And we'll talk about that, I'm sure, on our third program with Chet Awas, Professor Awas, who's conducting this work on the 17th of March. Because Bach does do that so well. He puts the emotion, the musical emotion, to the text, to each word in some cases.
Yeah.
And one question I know I'll ask him is, what chords are used? What musical parts are there to when the term the Jews is used in the music?
Yeah.
Because that would partly illuminate what Bach felt personally. Well, let's take a short break. We have a couple things to announce. Of course, this concert that's coming up for those who choose to go, March 17, at 7:30 in Smith Music Hall. It's a performance by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. That's BACH is the acronym. Very, very appropriate. Tickets may be purchased at the door. I don't know the cost of the tickets, so if one of our listeners would call and share that information, that would be helpful. People who would like to order tickets may do so by phone, 378-6802. But that number was busy when I tried to call and get the cost of the tickets to share on the air. So if someone else who's listening, perhaps someone who's performing in the concert, would give us a call here at 333-9455. You can just give that information to our engineer if you don't want to be on the air, or you can wait and you can tell me live. This is a live call-in program every Sunday evening from 5 to 6 p.m. here on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Listener-supported, of course, and the station always appreciates contributions to help bring these kinds of programs to our listeners. Coming up in the next 2 weeks, as I mentioned, Professor Rick Layton will be our guest next week, February 25th, talking about the Gospel of John's Passion story that this work by Bach is based on. And March 4th, Chet Awas, director of Bach, will be our guest, who's from the Department of the Music, the School of Music at the University of Illinois. Coming up later in March, Stephen Hartnett will be our guest, talking about poetry from prison. On Palm Sunday, we have a special treat. April 1st, Pastor John Sutherland will be our guest, who incidentally is a bit of a Bach scholar himself. He may want to add a comment or two even after this concert locally. He has sung with this group for many times. He'll be talking with us by phone from the West Bank in Palestine, in Israel. We'll talk about Palm Sunday in the Holy Land. Barack Okomas and others will be our guest April 8th, talking about the Intercultural Freedom Friendship Foundation, Intercultural Friendship Foundation. That's April 8th. And we have guests talking about green funerals, environmentally friendly funerals, burial services on April 15. The Campbells will be our guest on that day. Well, let's do mention a couple other things. Michael, you brought some information from the Jewish Culture and Society program as one of the sponsors of a musical event that's coming up just tomorrow. February 19 at 4 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum Auditorium, a klezmer music trio. What is klezmer music?
Klezmer music is the secular, festive music of the Jews of Eastern Europe. Draws heavily on Ukrainian, Gypsy, Romanian, Hungarian music. This group, Voretsky Pass, that's coming. They're superb musicians, and they are also very learned about the sources of the music. And the event tomorrow at 4 o'clock is a workshop. It's called Ask Dr. Klez. And people, they'll be there with their instruments, and they won't just answer the questions in words. They will demonstrate. And that should be a lot of fun.
So it's interactive.
It's very interactive.
That'll be tomorrow at 4 at the Spurlock Museum Auditorium on campus. And then there, the next day, on Tuesday, February 20 at 7:30, they'll also be at Smith Music Hall giving a free concert.
Right, right.
Well, two great, great opportunities. And that's sponsored not only by the Program in Jewish Culture and Society, but also the Center for Advanced Study, the School of Music, the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, the Jewish Endowment Foundation locally, and the Einhorn Endowment in the European Union Center. So that's should be a very interesting event. And there, the trio will also be could be heard tomorrow here on Focus 580. David Inge will be interviewing them. I don't know if they'll have their instruments in the studio.
They will.
Ah, okay. Well, that's at 10 o'clock tomorrow here on Focus 580. Is also a chance to hear that same trio in interview. Coming up this week at the University YMCA, which provides support for this Keeping the Faith program, on Tuesday, Melvin Skvarla from the Campus Historic Preservation section at the university will be talking about the arts of Illinois, specifically sculpture, here on the university campus, some which can be seen at the Krannert Art Museum. And he'll also be referring to sculpture, which can be seen at Allerton Park. That's a free lecture at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street. That's the corner of Wright and Chalmers. Tuesday at noon, that's February 20. And coming up on Friday Forum this week, I'm privileged to be able to be interviewing Rajmohan Gandhi, visiting professor at the university, and head of the Global Crossroads program at the university. Professor Gandhi has recently had a book of his published on his grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi, a biography of the great Gandhi in India. And I'll be interviewing live at the Y as part of the Friday Forum series, Professor Rajmohan Gandhi. That's a free lecture, and it's possible we may be able to tape that for a future play here on Keeping the Faith. We're not sure that's going to be possible, but for sure we're going to be interviewing him live at the Y noon this coming Friday. That's February 23rd. If you want to order a lunch for either the Friday or the Tuesday series, just call the Y, 337-1500, for some good Y Thai food from the Thai eatery. Well, let's get back to our guest today. We're talking with Professor Michael Shapiro about St. John's Passion by J.S. Bach, which will be performed Saturday, March 17. I think it's a Saturday. Maybe it's a Friday. At any rate, it's St. Patrick's Day.
I think it's a Saturday.
So is it? Okay, the 17th at 7:30 at Smith Music Hall. And listeners are invited to call in 333-9455 if you have a question from Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, toll-free 1-800-222-9455 if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question for our guest. Michael, you've mentioned some things about your study of this issue. Were there many Jews in the part of Germany that Bach lived and wrote in, composed in?
Yeah, in Leipzig.
Uh-huh.
Hardly any.
Really?
The same question comes up about Shakespeare. Uh-huh. They say, were there any Jews in London in Shakespeare's day?
Yeah.
And they were not supposed to be there. They had been banished from England in 1290, and of course there were some there, but whether Shakespeare knew any or not, hard to know. A similar problem with Bach. The Jews had were banished from Saxony. Leipzig is a major city of the Duchy of Saxony. The Jews were banished about 1540, I think, something like that. Before that, the Leipzig Fair had always been a great center for commerce of all sorts, and all Jews were active in it. And I think even after the banishment, they're allowed to come to the fair, but residing in Leipzig was not to happen. The first Jew who, after the banishment, came in 1710, which is just 13 years before Bach took up his duties at the Thomaskirche. And he was an interesting character and not at all unusual in the German-speaking world. He was what you could call a Hofjude or court Jew. Hmm. He was somebody with special talents that the political establishment needed, whether it often had to do with business, with purveying, with finding provisions for the army. It sometimes had to do with tax collecting. And the case of the man who came to Leipzig, he was a specialist in coining, making coins, his metal expert. So connection with Jews and finance, you might say, was already established. And typical of the Hofjude situation, the Hofjuden, they would say to their employer, look, I can't just come myself. I need to pray with 9 other Jewish men if I'm to have Jewish prayers. Mm-hmm. And my children need a teacher, and we need to buy kosher meat from a butcher. And we should have a ritual bath for my wife. And around the Hofjude, there develops a small community.
Sure.
Entirely dependent on his relationship with his patron. And there were some very well-known figures who held these positions. Both named Oppenheimer, one in Nuremberg, and the other one in Vienna, and they were very powerful because they essentially ran the government. They're like the steward. In a smaller scale, would be the steward of an estate. But if the estate is a country, then they are like the managing the country. And if they fell out of favor, it could be disastrous for them and for their whole entourage. And in some cases, they did fall out of favor, especially if there was a change of regime. So we don't know. I don't know a whole lot yet about. I'd love to know more about this man who, Gerd Levi, who was the mint, what's he called, the minter. I forget the German word for it. In Leipzig. So there couldn't have been many Jews. There were some converts to Christianity. I've read in Leipzig whom Bach might have known, but there doesn't seem to be, as far as I can tell, much contact there. Of course, when he did all of his work was done in the church. It was all religious occasions. We forget that sometimes. The concert that's going to be done in a few weeks will be in a concert hall, or it'll be open to the public. It's not part of a liturgical occasion. And so in Bach, the Jews would not have come. There were Jews singing, and it would not have been an issue at all. And it would have been surrounded by liturgy and sermon as well. So it's part of a larger liturgical complex, whereas today we go. And we that's why the caller who suggested that one could take an aesthetic approach to this is thinking along the way it is we go to hear other religious music in concert halls. We might hear the B minor mass, for example, played in a concert hall and not particularly think too hard about the liturgical occasion.
In the Michael Marison book that you referred to earlier, I've not read that, but I wonder if from his perspective he's looked at any of the sermons that might have been preached and perhaps written down on the occasions of playing this in the liturgical setting of Bach's time.
Yeah, he says they've not survived.
They have not.
Yeah, they would be a wonderful source, wouldn't they?
It be?
Yeah,
right.
Well, maybe someone will find them, but he couldn't find them.
So. Mm-hmm. Interesting. We have a caller on our toll-free line. Let's go to line number 4. Yes, you're on the air with our guest, Professor Michael Shapiro.
Yes, thank you. Professor Shapiro, first of all, do we have a sort of verdict? Was Bach himself anti-Semitic or not?
I don't see any evidence in his personal life or his social life, there's no evidence that he was.
Yeah, okay.
He had no contact with Jews to speak of, as far as we know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Also, you were just talking about the presence of Jews in German life about that time. Have you ever come across anything from the previous generation dealing with Heinrich Schütz, who was a predecessor of Bach's?
No.
Because I remember as a music student, when I was studying to be a musicologist 30 years ago, I remember coming across passages where Schütz encourages his students and his contemporaries to attend Jewish services whenever they could find them, because they would find new material for. He was so entranced with the Jewish liturgical services of the time in Western Europe and Germany. He felt that it would help enliven some of the traditions that were already out there in German and Western European music.
I've not heard of that. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it is. The fact that he even had access to the services themselves, particularly considering the dearth, I get this impression of him, donning some disguises. not only just so neighbors wouldn't know that he was doing this. If the anti-Semitic feeling was what it appears to have been at the time. I was just curious to see if you ever come across anything like
that. No, that's quite fascinating.
You mentioned you studied musicology. May I ask where you're calling from?
Well, I'm calling from central Illinois,
But
I'm originally a Clevelander.
I see, okay.
So back at Baldwin Wallace Conservatory, as a matter of fact, where we have the Bach festivals every year. So we got exposed to a lot of it in large numbers while undergraduates there.
It's an interesting question. Could Bach have gone to the services probably held in the home of the man who came to run the mint?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I'm not enough of a Bach scholar to really know the answer to that. It's an interesting question.
He did get around. He didn't spend his whole life in Leipzig.
At
one point or another, he may have encountered it. And in general, the accounts of him, contemporary accounts of him, give him to be somewhat gregarious. In other words, not nearly as much as Handel is contemporary, but at least he seemed to get along, have a gift for getting along with pretty much everybody, except perhaps his employers. And
which is one reason he moved around.
Right, exactly. But have you ever come across in your studies or archiving or anything like that, several decades ago, quite a few decades ago now, Time magazine ran an entire issue on the Passions of Bach, and it was entitled The Fifth Evangelist. And I believe the point they made was exactly some of the things you've illustrated today, is that he changed the face of how the Gospels and the Passions were presented, because by taking in the Martin Luther texts that admonished the Christians, the actual audience, that this is something that you have done, and it does appear in a lot of his work where things will stop, they'll go to the chorale or the chorus, and they'll actually say, now remember, you're the one that caused this to happen. And like I said, that was their point, is that was the author of the articles saw it as a sort of turning point.
Interesting. No, I haven't come across that. It's
in late 60s, I believe, early 70s, if you're ever able to do some archiving. It was a fascinating thing for Time at the time, gave you an idea of the sophistication of the readership, the fact that they could devote an entire article to John Sebastian Bach and the Passions and a lot of his choral work that way.
Yeah, well, I'd like to have a look at that.
Thank you.
Of course, let me just go on a little bit. The question of, interesting, and I'm sure this is known, the places where Bach lived and worked before Leipzig, whether there were Jewish communities, because there weren't Jewish communities everywhere, just as Leipzig had banished Jews. Many other cities had done the same, and there was a lot of movement. Jews were there's a wonderful book I used to use when I taught a course in modern Jewish literature called Gittel, of Helman, of Hamel, Memoirs of Gittel of Hamel. It begins with her saying, well, her family had to leave Hamburg because the Jews were thrown out, and they went to, I think, a place called Altona, and then they were thrown out there. And they were jewel merchants of jewels and jewelry, and it was very portable, so they could pack up when they had to. And much of her, the memoir, is a lot of it is checkered with this information of where Jews could go and where they had been but could no longer go and where they were readmitted. So, but I'm sure we know enough about Bach, and perhaps somebody could make these connections and see what Jewish life was like in some of these places.
Yeah.
I think there have been several suggestions that might end up being doctoral dissertations here.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Sure,
appreciate
thanks.
It. Let me give the numbers again. We have time for other callers. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana that will reach a couple local lines. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number for those outside of Champaign-Urbana. And incidentally, we're close to the time that the station drops to lower power. If you're listening to this and are fascinated and you have access to a computer, if the power drops and you can no longer hear this live, do go to your computer where it's being streamed. The site is WILL.UIUC.EDU and then AM 580. And you can click on that and continue to hear this. This program will also be archived there if you missed the first part and would like to hear that. You may go to that website later, and it'll be archived there, and you can hear all that Professor Shapiro has shared with us. We have another caller waiting on line number one. Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. They're related. When Michael was talking about the reading of the Purim scroll, he mentioned that in the Reform community they don't read the last part, and in the Orthodox community they do. And actually it's interesting the way it's read in the Orthodox community. It's read very quickly and in a low voice, which has two results. One is the explanation for doing that is that it's not appropriate to relish revenge or someone's demise. The slaughter is not something to glorify. But the other thing it does is it causes children to ask why it's being done. So it's an educational device, a purposeful educational device as well. And I wondered, maybe this is a question that Steve would feel more comfortable asking than Michael, but I'm curious whether in a church context anything is done about the Gospel of John and the problematic anti-Jewish aspects of it. Is it read in a different way? Is any educational effort made to talk about whether these claims against the Jews are historically true or theologically appropriate? And I'll just hang up and hear your answer. Thank you.
I'll hazard a personal response. As a Christian pastor in the Reformed Presbyterian tradition, I think the way the Gospels are interpreted and read in worship is very important. And in my past lives where I was preaching more regularly from the lectionary text, the assigned text for the different seasons of the year, once every 4 years, or 3 years rather, every 3 years, the John passages would be read at Easter season. I used that occasion as a way to talk about the dangers of anti-Semitism. And, of course, the Easter season, sadly, has been for many centuries a time of fear for our Jewish friends, and Christian anti-Jewish, not only rhetoric but action has been a horrible thing. So I tried to use that in times that would come up in the series to talk about those kind of issues and decry some of the things that my Christian brothers and sisters have done over the centuries. And remind Christians that they needed to ask forgiveness from their Jewish neighbors for that. In terms of translation, there are many contemporary English translations that don't use the term "the Jews" when they translate John, but instead have used other things like "the leaders of the Jews" or "some of the Jews" or "some of the Jews not in our little sect who are following Jesus." There have been various ways that's been translated as a way to try to mitigate that problem. I don't know that any of that is perfectly successful, but we'll probably get some more opinions on that next week when we talk with Professor Rick Layton from the Religious Studies program here at the university about the St. John's Passion story, and perhaps we'll have other Christian pastors who will call in and say what they do. That would be interesting. We probably don't have time for that between now and the end of this program, but next week we'll have another 58 minutes. So try for that. Michael, do you want to respond to that comment?
Well, I do think these problematic works like The Merchant of Venice and the St. John Passion do provide opportunities for education, and they should not be passed by. When theater department did The Merchant maybe a dozen years ago, I was asked to be the dramaturg. I think it was a very shrewd political choice on the part of the director. He had the head of Jewish studies as his dramaturg. But I asked him to meet with members of the Jewish community and have some parlor meetings and talk about the play. He got quite an earful of people who thought, why are you even doing this play at all? And what we came up with, and it didn't satisfy everybody, but what we decided to do was to have talk-back sessions after most of the plays, send graduate students out to the small communities where high school students are coming to matinees, weekday matinees, and in general use it as an educational opportunity to talk about some of the issues. And that's not going to satisfy everybody, but I think I do think that's the right thing to do.
And interestingly, this series of three programs on the air in preparation for the performance by the Baroque artists in Champaign-Urbana of the concert on March 17 at Smith Music Hall was partly done for that reason. This is an opportunity to educate people about the issues and to talk about it. We have another caller waiting. Let's go to that. Line number one, yes.
Yes, good afternoon. I am Jewish, but I do not know the reason why in the Book of Esther they talk about all this slaughter. And so I'd be happy to be educated. Please tell me, why did the Jews have to go on this rampage of slaughter?
Well, they were, you should read the Book of Esther, and you'll get the answer.
I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, but what you'll find when you look at the Book of Esther is that there's a plot to exterminate the Jews by Haman, the king's minister, and that plot was discovered and frustrated, and Haman fell from favor very abruptly.
And when it's read, you're supposed to hiss when Haman's name is mentioned.
You're supposed to obliterate the sound of his name by making noise. And there are special noisemakers called groggers you can bang on a pot or just scream. But it's a very festive holiday, and that part of it is a lot of fun. Looking at the text without, the hoopla, it's pretty grim. I mean, it was a liquidation.
It was a genocide.
Extermination. It was
course.
A genocide.
Absolutely.
Now, the Jews responded by committing going on a rampage. And it's one thing to kill Haman, who's the instigator of the plot. It's quite another thing to go after his sons and all his descendants. Again, we make light of it. Purim has become a kind of carnival holiday within the Jewish tradition, as you may know. And so we eat something called hamantaschen, which is a special kind of a cookie with filling, fruit fillings of one kind or another. Hamantaschen means Haman's pockets. But the Hebrew is a little tougher. It's called oznai haman. It's Haman's ears. And, there's a gruesome sort of gallows humor here. And it ends with this recitation of how many of his family descendants and supporters. It's, I think the number is 75,000. So that was an act of vengeance, you might say.
A very human response, but...
Not one to be proud of, necessarily. Yeah. I think that idea of reading it, I'd forgotten what our caller mentioned about reading it softly. I mean, that's a way of acknowledging that it's there, but paying special attention to it. And I think that's kind of interesting. It's something like the framing I'm talking about that Bach uses techniques.
Another thing that's done in Christian worship, and I'm not sure this is, again, fair, but huge portions of the Christian scriptures are never read in worship. Very different from the Jewish tradition, where the practice is to read the whole thing and then start over and read it again.
Right.
In much Christian worship, there are portions of the Bible which worshipers never hear.
Yeah. Well, it's good to know that what's there. It's a problem. My wife and I once were leading services, and we were reading from it wasn't the regular Torah service. It was a special Reform service where we read something out in English. What we read was an act of vengeance. It was the massacre of Shechem after the rape of Tamar. And our former rabbi was in the congregation that night, and he He's very upset with us. He said, you know, I was in the pulpit 40 years. I never read that out loud. I said, what are you doing?
The setting often is interesting. I've often found it helpful in educational settings to say, all right, here's some things that are in the Bible that we don't usually read, and particularly we don't read around children. Here's why. And let's read them in this setting and talk about why.
Yeah.
And why were they there? And why have I and other pastors chosen and committees of various churches chosen not to read these in worship? Do you think that's ever justified for musicians to say, because of this problem with Bach, we should never perform this piece?
I wouldn't say that myself. I wouldn't say that about The Merchant of Venice either. I wouldn't say that. I think people say, well, why don't we sanitize it, perform in some sanitized version? But then that doesn't really address the problem of what was there. So they have to be, I think, surrounded by some kind of educational apparatus and the occasion used for discussing the issues that are generated by these texts.
And in our last 30 seconds, outdated material, is there a good way to deal with it?
In the theater, they say they have a concept called museum theater, which is a sort of pejorative concept. You take this outdated material, but you show how it was done at the time. But people don't want to pay money to see how it was done at the time. They want to pay money to see a work of art that will speak to them in some way. If the outdated material can't be made to speak to us, I haven't got a good answer. Each text, I guess, would require its own kind of answer to this.
And we've talked about your answer for this particular text in this last hour, and we do appreciate your being here. Michael Shapiro is a professor emeritus from the Department of English here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and continues to be the director of the program in Jewish culture and society at the university. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll continue this theme of dealing with the St. John's Passion by J.S. Bach, which will be performed in Smith Music Hall on March 17, St. Patrick's Day at 7:30. Tickets are available at the door, or you may call and reserve tickets at 378-6802. Coming up next week, Professor Rick Layton will be our guest, talking about the document in this that Bach used, which is the Passion story, the story of the suffering and death of crucifixion of Jesus in the Gospel of John, in the Christian New Testament, the Christian Scriptures. On March 4th, our guest will be Professor Chet Alwes, who's also director of the Broke Artists of Champaign-Urbana, who will be directing this performance. He's a professor in the Department of Music, and we'll be talking about the music that's at the base of this. On Keeping the Faith, coming up after that, in March 11th, Stephen Hartnett will be our guest, talking about poetry from prison. And on Palm Sunday, April 1st, Pastor John Sutherland will be our guest by phone from the West Bank in Jerusalem, talking about Palm Sunday in the Holy Land. My name is Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
John Brown was a man who led a raid in Kansas that butchered 5 unarmed men. He was also arguably one of the few white people in 1850s America who was totally colorblind. So was John Brown a good terrorist? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll consider the legacy of this most complicated figure. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana. In 1942, 10 sisters walked into the Coles County Courthouse and were separated from each other and their parents. Monday night at 8, WILL-TV tells their story of loss and triumph in the locally produced documentary, Ten Sisters, A True Story. Tune in Monday night at 8 on our companion station, WILL-TV, PBS for Central Illinois. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy and not as cold. Temperature steady around 19 degrees with light southeast winds increasing to 10 to 15 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy and not as cold with a high in the upper 30s. Blustery with south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour and gusting. Tomorrow night, cloudy and not as cold with a low in the lower 30s and southwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.